This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We spend the full hour today examining Cincinnati's zoning laws, a possible reimagination of them, and also some of the racist history related to zoning. Coming up, we're joined live by two people pushing for zoning reform in the city through Instagram posts. And later, what the city might accomplish through reforms as explained by the director of planning and a member of council. But first, Richard Rothstein is the author of the best-selling book, The Color of Law, which includes an historical look at the emergence of zoning codes and some of the racial motivations behind them. I spoke with him earlier. Here is our pre-recorded conversation. Richard Rothstein is a distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute and the author of the book, The Color of Law, a New York Times best-selling piece of nonfiction published in 2017 about the historic connections between land use policy and segregation in America. He joins us via Zoom now. Richard, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
So I'm looking at this chapter in your best-selling book about racial zoning, and it includes an image of a leaflet from 1916 in St. Louis, and it's rather horrifying. I want to read some of the text. It says, "Look at these homes now, an entire block ruined by Negro invasion." It says to save your home and to vote for segregation. So 1916 was more than 100 years ago, but I mean, there are people walking around whose parents might have been part of this. Can you just set the tone for us, set the stage for us about what American cities like St. Louis or Cincinnati or Louisville were like in that period?
In that period, there were many, particularly border state cities, that adopted ordinances like that that designated communities as either all white or all black. They were only necessary from the point of view of the promoters because these cities were integrated at that time. We had much more integration, racial integration in the urban America, in the South as well as in the North, in the early 20th century than we have today. The typical ordinance of that kind prohibited African Americans from moving onto a majority white block or whites from moving on to a majority black block. Those ordinances would have meant nothing if it weren't for the fact that those blocks were already integrated. Well, the Supreme Court prohibited those ordinances in 1917, and it did so not because it was concerned about racial equality, but because at that time the Supreme Court thought that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution was designed to protect property rights, and these ordinances prohibited a white or a black homeowner from selling his or her home to anybody that they chose. But once the ordinances were declared unconstitutional on the grounds of property rights, the federal government began a program to create model exclusionary ordinances that could be adopted by cities all over the country for the purpose of accomplishing the same thing. Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover, beginning in 1921, created a commission to develop these zoning ordinances, and they were soon adopted all over the country. What happened next was that the federal government, in the post-World War II period, created suburbs on an all-white basis. Returning war veterans were subsidized to move into all-white single-family home suburbs from which African Americans were excluded by federal policy. The most famous of these is probably Levittown, east of New York City, 17,000 homes in one place. They were built all over the country. African Americans could easily have afforded those homes at the time. They were inexpensive. They sold for about $8,000, $9,000. Today's money, that's about $100,000. Any African American returning war veteran, or for that matter, any African American who had a job in the post-war economy could afford those homes. Well, those homes are no longer affordable to working class families of either race. They gained in value over the course of the next couple of generations. Homes in Levittown, for example, and this is true of suburbs all over the country. I don't mean to imply that Levittown was in anywhere unique. No longer sell for $100,000. They now sell for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. And those suburbs then adopted exclusionary zoning ordinances along the model that the Hoover Commission had created in the 1920s. And those zoning ordinances prohibited anything from being constructed within their borders that was not a single-family home, typically on large lot sizes. Well, this effectively excluded African-Americans from moving into those communities, even after the Fair Housing Act of 1968 said they were permitted to do so, because working-class families, middle-class families of either race can no longer afford to move into many of these suburbs. So the zoning ordinances, although they don't purport to be explicitly racial, serve the purpose of maintaining those communities as exclusively white suburban communities. And they didn't exclude just low-income housing. That wasn't their main purpose. Their main purpose was to exclude even townhouses, garden apartments, duplexes, triplexes, homes that working-class families who might include African-Americans could afford to purchase.
We're talking with Richard Rothstein, a distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute and the author of the book, The Color of Law. Richard, you referenced the Supreme Court decision. This involved a case out of Louisville, just about 100 miles south of where I'm sitting right now in Cincinnati. And I'm wondering, based on the research that you did for this book, was it just simply racism? Was there something that white people in this period were afraid of related to investments or their family and black people?
Well, it was a constructed fear. It's true that whites were afraid, but this fear was constructed. It wasn't something that they came up with just naturally. You know, in the mid-20th century, when African Americans' incomes began to rise somewhat and they were living in low-income segregated neighborhoods, poorly resourced, referred to as ghettos at the time, African Americans with good jobs, and many of them had them, wanted to move outside of those segregated low-income neighborhoods, and they typically bought homes in the white neighborhoods that were adjoining the center city. Those African-American homebuyers paid more for homes in those neighborhoods than whites would pay. If a white homeowner wanted to move for whatever reason, got a better job somewhere else, had a larger family, it was to the white homeowner's interest to sell a home to an African-American because African-Americans would pay more simply for reasons of supply and demand. There were so few homes that people were willing to sell to them that if somebody was smart enough to sell to an African-American, they were willing to pay more. And you could typically, in these neighborhoods, these white neighborhoods that surrounded black neighborhoods, you could typically identify which were the black homes because they were better maintained than the white homes. They were families with higher incomes than the whites. Well, once that happened, speculators, real estate agents descended on these neighborhoods to try to frighten white homeowners that, contrary to what was happening where property values were increasing when African Americans moved in, that the opposite would soon happen, that property values would fall. And they engage in tactics. We use the term blockbusting to describe it. In my book, The Color of Law, I describe a white speculator who boasted in a magazine article about the tactics he used. He hired white women to push baby carriages around the neighborhood. He hired young black men to drive convertibles around the neighborhood with radios blasting. He even boasted about organizing burglaries in the neighborhood to frighten white families that their neighborhood was becoming crime-ridden. Well, with this constructed fright, whites were persuaded that their homes were soon going to decline in value, contrary to all the evidence. That their homes are going to decline in value, and these speculators, these real estate agents, then purchased those homes from the whites at prices far below their true market value, and then turned around and sold them to African Americans at prices far above the market value. As I say, this blockbusting was a purely constructed fear that was not based on reality, and it was all government sanctioned. Because every one of these real estate agents who engaged in these practices was licensed by their state real estate agency. When civil rights advocates complained to state licensing agencies about the tactics that these blockbusters were using, the state licensing agencies declined to take any action, said it was none of their business. had the state licensing agencies abided by their constitutional responsibilities and lifted the licenses of speculators or real estate agents who were engaged in these practices, it never would have happened. So the fear of property value decline was a constructed fear. Let me give you one other bit of evidence. There have been some communities in the late 20th century that made a concerted effort to prevent blockbusting, to ensure that their neighborhoods became stable when they desegregated and became truly diverse neighborhoods. In some of these places, they adopted insurance programs where white homeowners could purchase insurance against a decline in the value of their homes. The programs were eventually abandoned because the insurance funds never had to pay out any money. There were never any instances of homes declining in value because African Americans moved in. So, as I say, it's a constructed fear and one that the government was easily capable of preventing but refused to do so.
Richard, when we look around some of these cities now, the ones that struggled with these issues a century ago and then throughout the 20th century, what can we identify as a legacy of that racism?
Well, we have all white or almost all white neighborhoods surrounding central cities, a white noose that the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administrations created with whites-only policies when these suburbs were created. And we have African Americans concentrated in lower-income neighborhoods that they have great difficulty exiting because they didn't gain the wealth that white homeowners were able to gain when they were subsidized to buy homes in neighborhoods that were rapidly appreciating. So the wealth gap that underlies so much of our racial inequality is a direct consequence of federal housing policies, as is the white suburban noose that exists around every metropolitan area.
And now we see the center cities starting to experience a renaissance in a lot of major American cities. And a lot of that is driven by investment that is bringing white people back to the city. And it's often criticized for its displacement of the black residents that have lived there historically. Has your research discovered anything related to the impact of that?
Well, you're certainly correct in describing that phenomenon. Again, the policies to prevent massive displacement of existing homeowners and renters in these neighborhoods, disproportionately African-American, the policies are well known. There's no mystery about them. We should be enacting rigorous rent control ordinances in gentrifying neighborhoods. We should be limiting condominium conversions. We should be enforcing inclusionary zoning rules that require developers to create mixed income housing that includes both market rate and lower income and moderate income housing to preserve the diversity of the communities. And we should be adopting property tax freezes in those communities so that the historic residents are not forced out because they can no longer pay the property taxes on homes that they may own in full without any debt. So the policies are well known. What we need in this country is a new civil rights movement that's going to demand the enforcement of those policies.
Here in Cincinnati, there's a lot of criticism right now related to affordable housing. There's a lot of housing developments going up, but not many, and certainly not enough, that are considered to be affordable. I'm wondering, based on the research you've done, you explored a lot of different cities in the book, The Color of Law. Do you know of any cities in the country that are getting it right or getting it close to right?
No, but I do know of many cities that are getting it closer to right, not yet close. There are many affordable housing ordinances, that inclusionary zoning that require some low-income units in every development. Many communities have these ordinances. Their failure is that they don't understand that it's not only low-income African Americans who are excluded from higher opportunity communities. It's middle-income and working-class African Americans who are also excluded, whites as well. Many of our hot housing markets provide housing that have some units that are affordable to lower-income families, but most working-class, middle-class families, African Americans, disproportionately earn too much to qualify for subsidized housing and too little to afford market rate housing. And I know of no cities that are systematically creating mixed income housing that would really address the problem of segregation. African-American middle class and working class families typically live in neighborhoods that are segregated, where the resources are less adequate than the neighborhoods where white families with identical incomes live.
Richard Rothstein is a distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute and the author of the book, The Color of Law, which spent time on the New York Times bestselling list in 2017. Richard, thank you so much for the information you provided and the time you gave us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next, the two local advocates who have taken to Instagram calling for changes to local housing rules. And later, the city's director of planning and a member of council join us. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Multifamily housing keeps more people in positions of being able to buy or rent homes with financial comfort. But citywide regulations limit the additions of new multifamily housing. The Instagram account, Legalize Housing, profiles local buildings that would be illegal if constructed where they are today. And joining us now live are the founders of that account, Mark Simon. Welcome, Mark.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And Nick Keeling. Nick, welcome to you also.
Howdy. Thanks for having me, too.
Join our conversation if you'd like, 513-419-7100, or email your thoughts to talk at WVXU.org. So, Nick, I understand you were a zoning official in Hamilton County. You learned a little bit about zoning rules. Tell us what you learned as it relates to multifamily housing that inspired you so much that you wanted to create this Instagram account highlighting lovely homes that would be illegal to construct in their areas today.
Sure. So for 2 years prior to my current position with Sorta Metro, the bus operator here, I was working for Hamilton County as an associate planner, basically handling a lot of the zoning issues for the unincorporated townships that surround the city of Cincinnati. And during that tenure for 2 years, I read a lot into the zoning code and even the city of Cincinnati's zoning code and learned a lot about how much of our housing stock is impacted by these zoning codes and exactly the rules and regulations that relate to multifamily houses. And even at the time, and I still do live in a multifamily home, a duplex that is illegal. And so that kind of got the fire started and got me very passionate about learning more about how zoning impacts multifamily housing.
Mark, you have a similar background in having studied planning, and you worked in the city's planning department as an intern, I understand, and then for the county also. What do we know about the number of units that would be illegal if they were constructed today where they are in the form that they're in?
Yeah. So essentially, when you have a single family zone, it means that for every lot of land, you can only have one unit on it. And that's a hard rule. And so about a little over half of all of the land in the city of Cincinnati that is zoned, that is residential is zoned single family. Now, it wasn't always like that. A lot of the single-family zoning was created in the 60s and reinforced in 2004, mid-2000s era. So a lot of areas where the urban environment is one, two, three, and four-family buildings is now single-family. So if a two, three, or four-family building or larger is in a single-family zone, then that building cannot be built today. It is, quote-unquote, illegal. So our rough estimates based on a study of parcels within the city of Cincinnati using GIS analysis is a very, very conservative number of about 20,000 units that are, quote unquote, illegal today. And that is we admit a severe undercount due to the limitations of some of our property data with larger buildings.
But those are units that are then grandfathered in where they are, right? These units exist as multifamily today.
Right. And the city and almost every city in America calls that existing non-compliant. So it exists. It does not comply with the current zoning, but it's allowed to remain as long as it is occupied and not vacant for more than a year. So after that year, the building cannot be used as it was and must revert to, if it is a single family zone, a single family home.
I'm looking at some of the properties that you profile on the Instagram account, which again is called Legalize Housing. So if you were to search for it on Instagram, it's at Legalize Housing, all one word. These don't look like they would work necessarily as single family buildings, right? They have multiple balconies and that sort of thing. They were built as apartment buildings. So how exactly would that work if they were made to revert to single family housing, Nick?
So a lot of these properties, usually if someone bought a former duplex, they would basically either have to combine two units, maybe by opening up a wall and turning it into a, so let's say you have a duplex where the second floor is a unit and the first floor is a unit. I've seen conversions where they usually just, break open a door between these two units or build a new stairwell, and then it forces the new property owner to basically heavily modify this building into compliance, or they just can keep it like it is, but they just are legally not allowed to be selling off the second unit or renting the second unit. They have to only have one unit and then one unit inside of that the entire time.
Right. And it doesn't mean that that unit has to be it does mean that unit legally has to stay vacant if there's more than one unit in the building. Of course, sometimes people rent buildings out without following all of the code and procedures. But legally speaking, if you have a three-unit building, a triple-decker with one unit on each floor, and it's vacant for a while, legally only one of those units can be occupied or you have to combine them.
We're talking with Mark Simon and Nick Keeling, the co-founders of the Instagram account Legalize Housing, which profiles local building that would be illegal if constructed where they are today in their multifamily format. Mark, as it relates to a shortage of affordable housing in Cincinnati and across the counties, we've heard there have been estimates by local organizations indicating that there's a lack of about 40,000 units across Hamilton County. What impact does this type of zoning restriction have on that, do you think?
Sure. So the primary impact is that it reduces just the raw number of homes that can be built. So if you have a single family zoned area, and there's 100 lots of land, you will only ever have 100 units of housing there. Now, if you were to allow more dense building, 2, 3, or 4 family buildings, then you can have more than 100 homes. So once it becomes such that more than 100 people want to live in that area, if you can't build new homes, then prices go up because people start bidding, people start bidding wars. And generally, those with the least ability to pay get left out.
Nick, we're promoting this Instagram account in this conversation, Legalize Housing. What is it about that forum, the social media platform Instagram, that is advancing the arguments you all are putting forth?
Sure. Yeah, a lot of zoning resolutions that dictate this language have very complex language that often only people that have studied it or developers and people that specialize it understand. So we found that Instagram was the best way to make it digestible to the common populace, to make it easy to basically tell people, hey, this is something that we find unjust. We tried to simplify exactly what the language says so the average person can learn exactly how these rules and regulations are impacting them without having to go to 4 years of university to learn how to read their local codes and ordinances.
And so when we bring up issues related to zoning, we know that politically the nation, the area are pretty well polarized on a number of issues. Mark, what are we finding as it relates to zoning and people's politics, if anything?
So most people kind of their eyes glaze over when you talk about zoning. But when you put it into things like number of housing units or just the construction of new housing and the preservation of existing housing, people are a lot more receptive to the idea of allowing slightly more dense buildings. So, for example, I live in Northside. I've lived there for a couple of years in a house that is zoned single family, and most of the neighborhood is zoned single family. Now, over the past 10 years, Northside has had a lot of new development, specifically large like apartment buildings along Hamilton Avenue, and rehabilitations of older, more rundown homes into renovated single family homes. So even with all of the new apartment units in development, there's actually fewer units as a whole in Northside than there were 10 years ago. And it's because far more former duplexes and triplexes have been either torn down and replaced with a single family home or converted into a single family home than new units that have been built. So on the affordable housing kind of side of it, we want to build new affordable housing units, but if we're losing more than we're building, then it's a wash, right?
And we're talking with Mark Simon and Nick Keeling, the co-founders of the Instagram account Legalize Housing, which profiles local buildings that would be illegal if constructed where they are today under current zoning laws. Nick, are there other cities you're looking to for examples that Cincinnati might follow?
Sure. So in regards to the conversation of legalizing duplexes, quadplexes, triplexes, it's pretty common to have these conversations, especially in the cities that are rapidly growing, like Seattle, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, the cities, especially on the coastlines, that have been growing exponentially. Those are the cities that are having conversations about legalizing this housing stock. What we've seen, especially for Cincinnati's case and historically post-industrial towns, is that we already have a plethora of this housing stock available. We already built tons of duplexes, quadplexes, and triplexes all across the city that were built before current zoning regulation. So obviously they are existing non-compliant units. And so right now what we are seeing is that we're actually coming from an historic preservation point of view as well, because a lot of the conversations about missing middle housing, which is the name for these homes that are banned per zoning code, a lot of those conversations are happening into these booming cities. But for Cincinnati's case, we have this housing stock. And so this is actually the first example we've seen in regards to not just protecting our current preservation, but also embracing future development as well. And so we're kind of riding it as we go right now.
And considering your perspective on this issue, advocating to, I guess, legalize these buildings that currently exist in multifamily form, allowing for more multifamily construction, are there parts of the city that stand out more than others as examples of this issue, this problem where there are a number of them that would possibly be converted to single family if ever the situation arose?
So actually, my current neighborhood, West Price Hill, and right next to me, East Price Hill, they are some of the most impacted neighborhoods per zoning code. Most of Price Hill is full of multifamily housing that was built more than 100 years ago. And most of the zoning code now has listed Price Hill for single family residency. And so up to 18,000 units around the entire city are impacted by codes like this. For Price Hill alone, it's around 5,000, 6,000 units that could be lost forever if the zoning code is not updated to include this type of housing stock. And that doesn't even go into future housing development as well. That's just our existing housing stock.
Just to add on to that, you know, West and East Price Hill show up really high on the number of units, but every single neighborhood is not in the basin, not downtown over the Rhine West End. Every single neighborhood has at least dozens, most have hundreds of units that do not comply with the zoning. And remember, these all had to have been built before the zoning changed. So all of these buildings have been continuously occupied since the 60s or the mid 2000s during Cincinnati's period of substantial population decline. So they are definitely in demand as housing units.
Mark, in our next segment, we're going to hear from a member of City Council as well as the city's director of planning. What action steps are you all taking to work with the local government to try to achieve what would be your goals?
So the first step was educating people. And part of that was the Instagram account, but also having meetings with council members and having meetings with our local community councils in the neighborhoods that we live in to sort of test the waters and gain support. And when we find that maybe 98, 99% of people we talk to did not know that you could not build 2, 3, and 4 family buildings today in much of the city, right? It just didn't occur to them, or they just didn't know. So there's that education piece, but the next piece is the policy itself. So zoning is a municipal function in Ohio. So cities have almost full control over their zoning code. So at the end of the day, a change comes when a majority of city council passes an ordinance to modify parts of the zoning code text or change the zones themselves. So that is sort of the ultimate end goal. And we've started the education part and we're meeting with people, and it's not going to be a short process because nothing property or development related is, but it's a mid and long-term goal to get the city's zoning to match not only the existing built environment, but the kind of city that we want to live in.
We know that affordable housing will be on the ballot for Cincinnati voters in the May primary, with advocates of more affordable housing suggesting that the city should spend $50 million per year to make more such stock available. Nick, do we think that this issue, as you presented, is something that will resonate in that conversation? And will people running for city council and mayor this year pick up on it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. This is a conversation that we have gained bipartisan support from. From the more conservative standpoint, this is in regards to property rights and your right to have multiple units on your land. And so we've had support from the more conservative side of people, and people that say the market can solve housing shortage crises. And for Cincinnati's purpose, well, preserving these existing units is a great way for the market to preserve affordable housing. And then for embracing future development as well, this also gives us a nice buffer for affordable housing. And also paired with future affordable housing policy, it will substantially help our existing affordable housing crisis for the city of Cincinnati.
Nick Keeling and Mark Simon are co-founders of the Instagram account Legalize Housing. We've got a link at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab in case you want to check that out. Mark and Nick, thanks so much for the time you gave us today.
Thank you very much.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. What might the city do to address a demand for more multifamily housing? I spoke earlier with the city's director of planning and a member of council exploring options. Here is our pre-recorded conversation. Joining us now is Cincinnati City Council member Jan Michelle Kearney. Councilwoman Kearney, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Looking forward to this discussion.
We're glad to have you back. And also with us is the director of the Cincinnati Planning Department, Catherine Keogjors. Catherine, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So we're talking about zoning, and this is probably one of those government issues that a lot of people don't pay a lot of attention to unless it directly impacts a project near their home. But it is rather important. It literally shapes the way a city looks. And we've been talking a lot on this program. Other media outlets have talked about this. It's certainly a conversation in the community, affordable housing and the shortage thereof in our city and in Hamilton County. Councilwoman, there appears to be an approach, a possible remedy, at least in some regard, to the affordable housing shortage related to zoning. Can you explain what you're exploring?
I'd love to. Let me tell you two quick stories, okay? Two quick personal stories. So, you know, in addition to being, you know, a wife, a mom, a small business owner, an attorney, and now a city council member, I'm also a realtor. And so a few years ago, and I want to say about 3 years ago, I was listing a two-family house in Pleasant Ridge. And before I even finished getting it on the multiple listing service, a young couple called me and said, can you show it to us right now? So I hadn't even put the photos on yet. I had just put in the basic information. So they were in a hurry to see it. It was a Friday afternoon. So I ran, I showed it to them, and they said, we're going to have an offer to you by the end of the weekend. And I said, wow, you know, what's the big hurry here? You know, I was happy about that, but they said that they had been looking for a two family. They couldn't afford the mortgage for a one family. They were a young couple. They weren't even married yet. They were getting married in about 2 months after, you know, after I met them. And they needed something they could afford, and they really needed a tenant to help them pay their mortgage. And so they said every time a two-family came on the market, it would just get zipped up before they could even see it. And so they were really anxious to get their offer in. So that was on a Friday afternoon. By the end of the weekend, by Sunday night, we had multiple offers on this two family. And the seller ended up getting a lot more for the house than we had actually listed it for because they got into this bidding war. And I thought, wow, that's really something. You know, that was great. So it worked out. This young couple ended up getting it. So I was really happy about that. And then fast forward another year or two to my family. So my mother-in-law, we would love for her to live with us instead of living by herself. But she doesn't want to live in the house with us. She said she's very independent. You know, she's doing great. And she said, you know, she wants her own place. She wouldn't mind a two family, but she doesn't want to just move into our house. And so there are a lot of families out there that are multi-generational and would like to live together. We are one of those families. So I started looking for two families, couldn't find any. I mean, they're very, very rare. And so I started talking to people like Mark Simon, and he said, here's why you can't find any two family homes. It's because of the zoning code. So, and Catherine will explain about that. And so I'm saying that is a way, you know, two, three families, even these four families that Cincinnati has, really we're kind of known for. This is a way that young couples can afford to buy a house, moderate income families can afford to buy a house, multi-generational families can afford to actually live together. I mean, it's a great opportunity. It also increases density. So as we develop these neighborhood business districts, you have more people living in the area who can support businesses. Now, let me just say, having said all that, there are different community plans where they don't want multifamily housing. And so we understand that. We definitely don't want to force it on anyone. But some of these community plans are old. Some are like, you know, 10 years old or even older, even Plan Cincinnati. It's Plan Cincinnati from 2012, which one of their goals was to preserve single families. But there was also another goal in that plan, which was to increase multifamily homes. And so what we want to do is get this conversation started.
Well,
what would that do for
Councilwoman, what do you see that doing for affordable housing access? If there is more multifamily housing available, how does that improve the affordable housing situation? You know, someone's still going to have to pay some rent. Somebody's still going to have a mortgage, right?
Right. But it's shared. And so you have the homeowner. Let me just say home ownership in Cincinnati is really low. The last time I checked, it was about 38% in low and moderate income neighborhoods, you know, black and brown neighborhoods. It's even lower than that. And so and, you know, nationwide, it's something like 62%. So we're way behind in home ownership. So having a multifamily home is another way of increasing home ownership, just like that couple that I spoke about. They were saying they can't afford a mortgage just by themselves, but if they have a tenant to help them pay the mortgage, that gives them home ownership. Now they're building equity. And so, you know, as they get married and have kids, so now they have equity where they can start a business or send their children to college. And they're building multi-generational wealth. So home ownership is so important. And because of redlining and, you know, other practices that happened in the past, a lot of low and moderate income black and brown families have missed out on that. And in addition, it helps, as I said, young couples who can't afford a mortgage without some help. It helps multi-generational families. So it's really an opportunity. It doesn't solve the entire affordable housing crisis that we're having, but it is one way of helping. And so it helps all of these areas. In addition to, as I said, helping neighborhoods to have more density if they need it, for example, for their small businesses. So there are a lot of advantages, but each community has to look at their community vision and plan to see if this is something that would work for them. And so we want community councils, community groups to start this conversation and to take a look at it.
That's Cincinnati City Councilwoman Jan Michelle Kearney. We're also joined by the City of Cincinnati Planning Department Director Catherine Keogh-Jores. And Catherine, is this something that people in your position across the country are examining. We know that single family zoning is something that large cities are potentially reconsidering.
Yes, that's right. Cities across the country are looking at ways to use the zoning code to not only increase affordability, but also to allow for some of that multi-generational living that the council member was talking about. And cities are trying it in a lot of different ways. Some are doing it by providing incentives to maybe allow an increase in density, which they're also seeing as a positive thing if affordable housing is included in a development project. And then I think, you know, many of us have been following the city of Minneapolis that has been looking at making changes to its single family zoning district specifically to also allow two and three family structures to be built in that those districts that previously only allowed single family housing.
Well, I know you're a staff member at the city, so I won't ask whether you agree or disagree with one of the elected officials at City Hall, but maybe you can help us understand the philosophy behind what the councilwoman is saying. How does, I guess, reducing single family zoning, adding more opportunities for multifamily units, improve access to housing options for people who are right now priced out of the market?
Sure. Well, I think that she did a great job of explaining it already, so I won't add too much to that. But I do think that it's about, you know, increasing density and increasing the supply and the availability, and maybe some different sized units as well.
And, you know, Michael, let me add too that residential zoning reform does not prevent single family homes from being built. It just expands the options.
Okay. And so you're on the neighborhoods committee. Are you hearing from different parts of the city about a demand for more multifamily units?
Well, it's a little premature because we're just getting the conversation started. We've heard from individuals about it. People, you know, just like me saying they'd like to, you know, have their mother-in-law live with them, you know, or their grandkids move in, you know, whatever. So we've heard a lot of that, you know, young couples saying they would love it. But in terms of an overall demand, we are just starting the conversation and really need to see what the different community groups want. I mean, community engagement is super important in this process. We're not going to come into someone's neighborhood and just change all the rules, right? So we have to see what each community wants.
When you think about people saying we need either a reduction in single family zoning so we can add more multifamily units in places, how does it work?
Sure. Well, first, if you don't mind, if I just step back for just a moment and talk just a little bit more about in general how the zoning code works. The zoning code guides use, of course, how you can use the property. But then there are also very specific development regulations that guide how you can develop on the property as well. So in the city of Cincinnati zoning code, which is similar to many other city zoning codes, we do have districts for residential uses, and we do split those up between single-family districts and multifamily districts. But we also have office districts and commercial districts, our downtown district, districts specifically for manufacturing, special districts along the riverfront, and then also our park and recreation district. And then we also have special review districts that we also refer to as overlay districts that guide, for instance, our hillside development. So how things get developed on our hillside, how things are developed in what we call our urban design districts, which are around specific neighborhood business districts throughout the city. And then also, of course, our historic landmarks and districts. So as you know, we have a number of historic landmarks and historic districts throughout the city of Cincinnati, and there are special regulations that apply to them as well. So in the single family zoning districts, some of those districts are specifically for really single family development only. So development of single family homes that are based on lot size. So you have everything from the single family two, which is on a 2,000 square foot lot, which is a pretty small lot. So think like your Mount Adams is an SF2, where you have a lot of single family homes that are really tight together and may even be touching each other, but are mostly single family in nature, all the way up to the SF20, which is on 20,000 square foot lot. lots, which are really, you know, large lots. And you might think of those in some places like Hyde Park or Westwood. And then everything in between on 4,000, 6,000, and 10,000 square foot lots. And there is some single family zoning in probably every one of our 52 neighborhoods. We also have multifamily districts. So we have multifamily zoning districts that allow for you to build apartments that are really large scale or even smaller in scale. And then we also have what we call the residential mix zoning district, or the RMX, which allows for 1, 2, and 3 families. And you will see, you know, as kind of a pattern all across our neighborhoods, you'll see commercial zoning in the business districts, maybe surrounded by some office zoning, and then single family and multifamily zones kind of sprinkled throughout, really, you know, creating a kind of a quilt across the city. And so when the council member is talking about making changes to the zoning code, I'll let her talk more about this, but I think what she is referring to is maybe in some of those single family zoning districts, allowing for 2 families, 3 families to be constructed. There are, as you know, probably throughout our city, 2 families, 3 families, even 4 families that are mixed in to those single family districts already. And for those that are already there, those are considered legal nonconforming uses. So they are still allowed to exist. You're allowed to sell them. You're allowed to, you know, continue to use those as 2, 3, and 4 family structures, even though they're in a single family zone. But that's right. You would not be able to build a new multifamily use in a single family district currently.
And just to set the way planning works here, Catherine, you certainly enforce policy. You don't create policies, right? This is something that works its way through the electeds, and then that's the law of the city, and then you execute that.
That's correct.
And so council...
Right, so it's only our job on council.
Exactly.
To set policy.
You say,
right?
The conversations are really just getting started at this point, Councilwoman. Do you have a timeline or a hoped-for timeline when you might see more action towards this goal?
In terms of timeline, we haven't set a timeline, but the community engagement piece is really, really important. And we want to get these conversations started, let community councils meet, let residents meet, and start thinking about how do you envision your neighborhood? Is this an option you would consider? Because we really recommend it. I'm telling you, as someone who's struggling to find a home where we can have multi-generations, I mean, it's really tough. It's really hard.
That's Councilwoman Jan Michelle Kearney, and we've also been joined by the City of Cincinnati Planning Department Director Catherine Keogh-Jores. Councilwoman Catherine, thank you so much for the explanations. I feel better informed about zoning, and I'm sure we'll have cause to talk about it again. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.